ABC Radio Australia.
Over the last 2 days on Pacific Beat, we've heard from Jennifer Spandy from the US State Department spell out the thinking behind Washington's Pacific Pledge. It covers tens of millions of dollars in additional aid, an increased security presence in some countries, and assistance with climate change disaster preparedness. It also reflects Washington's concern over China's growing influence in the region. But at the same time, the US insists that since World War II, it's been ever present in the Pacific. Richard Ewart takes a look at how the American spin on the Pacific Pledge stands up to scrutiny.
In the wake of the step up in Australia and New Zealand's reset, the United States have been late to the Pacific Party in the eyes of many, and their claim that they've been present in the region since the Second World War doesn't ring true. Dr. Siobhan McDonald is a legal anthropologist from the Australian National University who is working closely with the government of Vanuatu as they seek to take big emitters like the US to court over climate change.
I think this is what they're trying to pull on, right, is this historical set of connections. You know, we are not only recently discovering the region, discovering in inverted commas, we've been here for a longer period of time. We have these long set of relationships. Pacific Island countries are not silly, though. They can see the effect of countries that have pulled out and are now choosing very late in the piece to re-engage.
Pacific analyst Dr. Tess Newton-Cain from Griffith University in Brisbane says the US would do better to abandon the World War II mantra and look to more recent impacts in the region, notably that funded by the Millennium Challenge Corporation.
You know, I was in Vanuatu last week, and even still people said to me, one of the most significant bits of development we ever got was the roads that were built by the Americans under the MCC. Now, that happened way after World War II, but that doesn't seem to get a mention in the rhetoric or in the diplomatic language about we've been here all the time.
And more generally, the tone of the American message and the way they're delivering it in the Pacific continues to raise eyebrows.
Sometimes the conversation can have quite a patronizing tone when it's directed towards Pacific leaders. And I think that's true of a lot of the hyperbole around Chinese debt traps. The idea that Pacific leaders are not making strategic decisions in this space is something that's often missed.
I have raised with American interlocutors that I've connected with this year, one of the things I've said to them is this isn't 1942 anymore. And one of the key things that needs to be remembered is that unlike in 1942, the countries that the US is now seeking these relationships with are sovereign independent states.
Under a president like Donald Trump, who doesn't believe in the science, it's perhaps surprising that the Pacific Pledge pays any attention to climate change at all. But Dr. McDonald says both Washington and Canberra have adopted somewhat schizophrenic strategies.
At a top level, at a prime ministerial level, they're not prepared to accept some of the language attached to the emergency of climate change in the region. But on the other hand, they are prepared to put funding into disaster, extreme weather event funding, resilience facilities. The reality, however, is that Pacific Island nations are increasingly saying to the US and to Australia in particular, you need to step up into this space. You need to acknowledge the Boyd Declaration that climate change is the single greatest security threat to the region. And we're expecting you to come with action.
So what is driving the US Pacific Pledge? Well, China for sure, but what about Australia's role? Tess Newton-Cain says the Washington-Canberra relationship as far as the Pacific is concerned is complex and evolving, particularly as America doesn't have enough boots on the ground.
They see Australia and to a lesser extent New Zealand as primary sources of information about the Pacific and primary locations of understanding about the Pacific. And again, I've heard Pacific people say to American thinkers in this space, come and talk to us directly, don't come via Canberra or Wellington. We would prefer a direct conversation. We don't want to have it filtered through other people.
And on the question of security and the US push to embed advisors in Fiji, Solomon Islands and Palau, Siobhan McDonald says it's getting mighty crowded.
Well, I mean, everybody is interested in being in this security space at the moment and getting as close to influence as is possible. So presumably an embedded security advisor is part of that strategy. Again, Pacific Island countries are not naive. They know if a security advisor is embedded, the interests of those security advisors are going to be divided, to say the least.
And furthermore, while the West may be suspicious of China, the Pacific Island nations rather like the Chinese way of doing business.
They appreciate the way the Chinese government is prepared to fund various infrastructure projects with less red tape, with less complications attached to them, for things that are a priority to the leadership of those countries. I think in that light, the US introduction of $350 million with an additional $100 million spend is not a very significant amount of funding.
And Dr. Newton-Cain says Pacific leaders can see through what some would characterise as the smokescreen of US ambition on good governance and media freedom in the region.
I've heard it particularly in Solomon Islands, but also in Vanuatu and in Fiji. They see this rush to be back in the Pacific, or this insistence that we never left, is very much seen as a reaction to activities by other partners, particularly China. And what Pacific Island leaders are looking for are relationships based on their own value in their own right. They're not interested in being pawns in someone else's geostrategic chess game.